Hi, I'm Dr. Elizabeth Sanders, a foot and ankle surgeon and assistant professor at Boston University Medical Center.
Hi, I'm Katrina Sanders. I'm a registered dental hygienist, consultant, international speaker, and wine lover.
And we're sisters. I grew up looking up to my big sister, Katrina.
And now I look up to my lady boss, physician sister, Elizabeth.
Together, we are working to unite the dental and medical communities in unique and exciting ways.
Welcome to Floss and Flip Flops with the Sanders Sisters, our monthly podcast,
where we unpack all things health related from your mouth to your toes.
So grab your flossy flops
and slide on some flippy floppies
and let's get on with the show. Hello and welcome to the first episode of Floss and Flip Flops in the year 2023. We made it to season two of Floss and Flip Flops with your favorite sisters, the Ginger Sisters. Hello, Dr. Sanders. How are you today?
I'm great. I had a great day. How about you? I guess I should preface by asking, do you know what time zone you're in, number one? And number two, how was your day?
Yes, I do. I'm back in Arizona time, which is really terrific, and living my best life. This past weekend I was traveling and got to see one of my friends from hygiene school. I'm sure you're like this from medical school, but like, you know, there's like a fraternity sorority thing that happens. In, you know, the professional allied sciences, I think. So I got to see one of my girlfriends from hygiene school. I haven't seen her since graduation day. So it's like crazy. So I was in Hawaii and got to see her. She lives on Kauai and she actually came in to Oahu to see me present for the Hawaiian Dental Hygienists Association, which was obviously amazing. This is where my work takes me, to Hawaii in December, which is amazing. But moreover, I got to see her. And then this weekend, I've got three hygiene girls coming in to visit me. So it's like a huge like whirlwind of like seeing my friends from college, which is so exciting. But of course, these are dental people. So it's just going to be lots of floss parties and
I wonder what you ladies talk about.
I know, exactly. It just cracks me up.
How exciting.
So yeah, I'm living my best life. How are you? Are you having a good day of treating patients and saving feet one toe at a time?
Yeah, I had a great day. I had a great day of clinic and then some cases that went very well. So thank you for asking.
We always like it when cases go well, don't we?
Yeah.
What's when they don't go well that you're like, I'm going to be documenting this experience for forever.
And maybe I'll be quitting.
I know. As a hygienist, even something small, like last week I was working on a patient. I work in perio. I was working on a patient and as I'm, you know, working with her, I noticed that one of her crowns was loose. So I work in perio and it's like, we're not really big, you know, we don't have a ton of cement just like hanging out in perio. So of course it's like, do you want me to take your crown out and put it in a Ziploc bag? Do you want to keep it in your mouth and potentially aspirate it or swallow it? And then you won't be able to have it re-glued back in, et cetera, you know? And then of course you're like, oh my gosh, this is going to take forever to document, right? Even though it's something quite frankly, truly simple. So,
what did you do?
Oh, she and I both agreed that it was, and I told her, I was like, it's going to be hard for me to sleep tonight if I send you out with that thing in your mouth. And she's like, okay. So of course I easily removed it, put it in a little Ziploc baggie, gave it to her and called the general dentist and sent her over there just to get it cemented. But, it's important, which I think is kind of a nice segue for our topic, our first topic of 2023, which quite frankly, to me, I think is going to set the tone for where this dialogue is going to move this year. And that is looking at the human mouth as a focus or focal point of infection. So I want to front load this by saying we have been studying the human mouth as a focus of infection since the 1800s, which is just crazy to me. Like when I was in hygiene school, we studied the oral systemic link and we studied that the mouth can be a source of infection. However, we were starting to study now, albeit I will say myself and all of my classmates who have been visiting me / I've been visiting over the past week, we graduated from hygiene school 15 years ago. when we graduated from hygiene school 15 years ago, we were still unpacking what it is that we understand about cardiovascular disease, diabetes, respiratory infections, et cetera. We knew, but we're still, you know, needing to create those links or corroborate those pieces in our research. So my first question to you is, in medical school, first of all, what pieces of information do you receive about the role that the mouth plays in systemic disease, systemic infection, inflammation, et cetera? What information do you get?
And I think we've talked a lot about this. I would have to say very little. We do talk a lot about the role of infection in the mouth leading to possible endocarditis.
But okay, endocarditis, really?
Mm-hmm.
So that's really your focus when, so, and I will front load this by saying it, you know, I respect you obviously, not only as my sister, but as a medical colleague, but you are far more educated in oral disease, what oral disease means, you know, et cetera. I mean, you stand on stages next to me and we talk about oral systemics. So you are pretty well versed. What would you say your average colleague, like if that's what they're learning is endocarditis, would you say that your average colleague in your, and I don't mean to say in your profession, but you know, because I think we're all healthcare professionals, but I guess what I mean to say is in your arena as a podiatric specialist, what is that what most podiatrists think of when they think of oral disease?
Yeah, I think so. And to also kind of describe though, I am a foot and ankle surgeon and I do have the ability, I work with a lot of other specialties. So I work with other general surgeons on the, with medicine doctors, with plenty of other specialties, including endocrinology. In fact, just last week, you know, I was on call over the weekend, I was doing cases and right next door in the operating room next door was the oral surgeon who was performing tooth extractions because apparently they're so behind with very, very sick patients that need tooth extractions. So now they're coming in on Saturdays to perform these procedures. So
What? So, yeah. So these were patients that were diagnosed with oral disease and need to be seen in a hospital setting? Or is it that these patients are longtime patients of the clinic and they haven't been discharged? And so now oral disease is happening while they're in the, what does that look like?
Yeah. So, and that's actually a good point. No, these are patients who I believe are mostly outpatient, who are just so sick that they can't even undergo a procedure in the clinic setting, what you do on a daily basis. So they have to come to the operating room just to go under anesthesia. A lot of the times they even do require admission afterward and they're so sick. So these aren't patients necessarily that I see. And okay. in it's my understanding, and I don't quite know, I could inquire if these patients are in-house patients who are admitted for even something differently, or if they are admitted for a significant infection in their mouth, are they then going to the operating room? But it's just, it's my understanding that their specialty is so behind with the number of patients that need these procedures that now they're coming in on Saturdays.
what do you mean by like the patient is so sick? Like what kind of conditions are we looking at with patients like this?
Yeah. And this is actually a great segue as well. And usually these patients are like a ASA class or like a anesthesia class above like a 3, 4, 5. So they have like cardiovascular disease, COPD, and diabetes, you know, it's a significant illness, but that's not even the half of what these patients have, or maybe they're cancer patients who are just so sick that they absolutely need perhaps a general anesthesia and they need an anesthesiologist.
Wow. You know, it's amazing because in dentistry, we actually, our brain kind of thinks the opposite. So, and which I, again, is just an awesome segue. I'm so excited for this conversation today. Oh my gosh. I need a glass of wine. I'm so excited. So this is what we think about in dentistry. We think this patient is an advanced ASA. And I'll say like, we study ASA. We need to know ASA classifications on patients in order to pass our national boards. So a patient who's an ASA 3, for example, an uncontrolled type 1 diabetic is classified as an ASA 3. Okay. Or this could be a patient who just had, I think it's like if you had a TIA or a stroke within the last 3 months, you'd be considered an ASA three. I'm sorry. You'd actually be considered an ASA four. My apologies. So based on like your proximity to having some of these major complications, you're going to be in an advanced ASA stage. Here's the issue. In dentistry, number one, when we hear that the patient had a heart attack less than 6 months ago, our first reaction in dentistry is we call the cardiologist to A, get clearance, or in many cases, most of us are telling the patient, I cannot touch you. I cannot see you until 6 months following your cardiovascular event. So if a patient said, I had a heart attack, there are many, many, many practice. I see you like reacting.
Yeah.
So I want to get your thoughts on this, but there are many, many, many practices that will say, if you had a heart attack in the last 6 months, I will not see you. Now, these are guidelines that dentistry, you know, has been programmed to follow. We, you know, these are like legit, like national boards questions for us. Like, how do you decide this patient? They just had a stroke. They just had a TIA 2 months ago. What do you do? And most of us, you know, would either do a consult or just wouldn't see the patient. So number one, that becomes a concern because I think the whole point of where we're going with this is what infection is lurking in this patient's mouth, either because they were admitted to the hospital, they were intubated, perhaps they, you know, maybe couldn't brush their teeth. So what infection is sitting in there? Number one, this is what we're going to talk about today. But I think the other piece of this is we are told that if the patient is an advanced ASA, that we should be very careful with anesthesia we use. We should be very careful with injectables. Maybe this is a patient we wouldn't inject with epinephrine, or we wouldn't inject with our typical lidocaine, articaine, you know, mepivacaine, you know, cocaine, just kidding. you know, these are patients that we would be very concerned in dentistry to use anesthesia on. And it's amazing that in the healthcare space, and I will share this caveat, in a hospital setting, when you have nurse anesthetists there, a CRNA, or you have an anesthesiologist who's there, who's overseeing all of those pieces, yes, you're far better prepared to manage a potential medical emergency in a hospital setting where there's like, you know, the paddle, you know what I mean? Like yeah. If something were to happen, you're more prepared in a hospital. There's no question about it. But I guess what I mean to say is dentistry is like, oh, if you just had an episode or you just had an event happen within a certain proximity of time, we won't touch you. And it goes back to, I think, number one, in our textbooks, you know, our major periodicals, we have been encouraged to do so. Number two, and I think the bigger issue here is when we provide therapy, debridement, we're going to, you know, do some periodontal scaling, we're going to use an ultrasonic instrument or, you know, whatever that may be. When we do those things, that we are kicking up bacteria from the bloodstream or from the oral cavity into the bloodstream, that bacteria is circulating through the body. And we do have concerns that these individuals who just had an episode or an event may not have the strength in their heart muscle, or may not have the immunity built up, or may experience delayed wound healing, where it may not be advantageous for us to do an intervention. So we encourage the patient to not see us. And we tell them to brush and we tell them to floss and keep things really great and clean at home, which by the way, also kicks up bacteremia. Because anytime that, I mean, just chewing will kick up bacteremia.
That's literally what I was just thinking. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So chewing, flossing, water flossing, brushing, anything like that is going to kick up bacteremia.
So can't you be the person to say that this bacteria sitting there is even a larger risk of then perhaps embolizing to the heart, like what we're talking about, or causing for a bacteremia, then leading to even bigger consequences?
For sure. And that's this weird teeter totter that we sit on of like, and we all call the risk to benefit ratio, right? So what is the risk of us providing this? And I hate to say it, but in dentistry and medicine in the Americas, for sure, maybe not necessarily other countries, but in the Americas, for sure, part of the risk that we look at is our legal risk.
Like
we worked very hard for our license, so we want to maintain that. However, I had a patient last week that said he lived in Indonesia for several years. And he said, you know, it's so interesting if you're an Indonesian trained doctor or dentist that you are very protected. So there were several times that he went in to have like a root canal done and they did a root canal on the wrong tooth. And I was like, okay, in the States, there is no way that that could like happen and that you'd like, that you know, the state association would protect that doctor.
Yeah,
like
we have
in the States, like
for a reason.
Right. Yeah. Like you guys, when you amputate, don't you write like yes and no on the feet that are before the patient even, so you're like, okay, so this is the one we're cutting off today. How do you feel? Like, is that what you guys do?
That's exactly right. And we have multiple checklists. Everyone verifies because wrong site surgery, I mean, let's be honest, we amputate the wrong toe, the wrong foot. That's legitimate. If you brought me to court and I did that, I understand.
Yeah. And your patients are sedated, but you've practiced right in areas where patients are not sedated, right?
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. Sometimes they've been wide awake.
I can't even, that was in Russia, right? When your patients were like, they just went get an epidural or something. And yeah, they're just like awake, like getting their toe removed.
Oh, that honestly, which is even more startling, in Russia, they would do huge reconstructive lower extremity surgeries. Like, you know, those big frames that they would put on the external fixators that I've showed you, they would put them on the legs, on the thighs, and patients were literally just sedated. Like, and then they, not even sedated, they would give them a spinal and then hang a bag of saline. And they just be sitting there talking to me. They were like, oh.
And the patient's like talking to you while this is like happening. Like they're just listening to a book on Audible, like or whatever. Just
no, they just talk
just
to us and
a sensible
tell
surgery
Trump,
done.
Tell Trump we're friends. It's all right. Don't you worry.
Ooh,
but they're just more hardcore than us. You know, it's just them.
They are quite hardcore.
I do have a question for you, just a little question on the side. Do you always use epinephrine in your local anesthesia?
Not always, but we do pretty routinely. And this is kind of an interesting piece because epinephrine we use as a, you know, true vasoconstrictor. There's a lot of bleeding that happens. We can't tourniquet like you do. Mm-hmm. You tourniquet, right? Mm-hmm. So if you like cut off a foot, it's not like squirting blood everywhere. We can't tourniquet the head, turns out, because then, you know, it would cut off blood to the brain. It would probably be bad. We shouldn't be laughing, but it is. You know, can you imagine? Like, I'm just going to, I'll do that for my next patient. We're going to tourniquet your head. You just start putting a little scarf on their neck. But, you know, the whole point being, we do get a lot of bleeding, particularly when we're treating gum disease or you're extracting a tooth. So yes, we do use it as a vasoconstrictor, you know, to keep, not only to constrict the blood vessels, but it also, because it constricts the blood vessels, it stops the anesthetic solution from entering the bloodstream faster and circulating through the body faster. So although we do have warnings, or we have what's called a cardiac dose, which is a very specific dose, the amount of epinephrine that is safe for a patient, 0.04 milligrams of epinephrine or 0.2 milligrams of levonorgestrel, which we can safely give to a cardiovascular patient and not stress out that heart muscle. But we've even found that for our patients that do have systemic complications, if we give them a vasoconstrictor like epi or like levonorgestrel, which is a synthetic form of epi, if we give that to them, that it could actually have an advantageous benefit in that the patient may not bleed out as much, which is great for our patients that, you know, maybe, you know, clotting is an issue, or, you know, thinned out blood could be an issue. It's also really great for those patients where we don't want to dump, we don't want to have a huge systemic acquisition. That vasoconstrictor works on the smooth muscle of the blood vessel. And so we know that if we can get some of that constriction, that it, you know, potentially reduces the amount of systemic anesthetic that gets dumped into the system. So sure, we do look at those things. Isn't that interesting? We aren't all different foot surgeons and oral
surgeons? Not at all. And the reason I was asking was because let's say a patient came to me with an infected ingrown toenail and they told me they had a heart attack 2 months ago. Okay. Because it's infected, I still have to go ahead and do the procedure. I do. But if it was not infected, I would say, okay, and I know that it's giving you pain. I unfortunately can't really do it during the 6 months after your procedure, after your heart attack, because you're on anticoagulants and you will probably bleed a significant amount. Or I might even consider using epinephrine in the foot so that I can do my procedure, and because I can't take them off their anticoagulants.
Sure.
But if there's an infection in the foot, it doesn't matter. I would still do the procedure no matter what. So that's why I was kind of asking you if maybe that had something to do with your 6 month rule.
Oh, no. It's what's interesting about this is actually if a patient is in pain, if they're in chronic pain like that, it's already raising their blood pressure.
Good point. Very good point.
And we know part of our issue is that within the first 6 months, it's like, what's that show? 48 hours. And you know, that show 48 hours is like, you know, they say you've got 48 hours after a crime happens to find, you know, the whodunit, because if you don't, you know, it's likely that they've already, you know, gotten on a, you know, train to Amsterdam or whatever they're doing. So, you know, that's the, you know, time you really need to be concerned, all hands on deck. Well, that proximity from having a cardiovascular event, the likeliness that that individual is very prone to another event, you know, happens within that window of time. So that's really what we're concerned about. But it's so interesting as we take a look, and I want to kind of dive into today's topic. What we're really talking about is the risk of treating, the risk of not treating versus the benefit of treating or the benefit of not treating when the patient has an infection in the mouth. So you'd mentioned that in medical school, the vast majority of the education that you receive is around the concerns that if there's infection in the mouth, that the patient could be potentially more prone to infective endocarditis. But it's interesting because medical colleagues have been studying this concept of the focal point of infection, as I'd mentioned earlier on, since the 1800s. We didn't have, I think, and I'm going to embarrass myself by saying this, but I think the very first dental school in the United States was founded in the 1840s on the East Coast. And when, you know, dental schools started to open up, the hope was that we would be able to create a subspecialty within medicine that focused on the mouth. That was really the point of dentistry coming to be. And part of the issue with this was that dentistry, although it could have been a medical specialty, it actually was this proposal to make dentistry a medical specialty was rejected. And it was rejected because the medical schools where this proposal was being placed didn't have the funding to create a dental school as a subspecialty. They did not have the funding at the time. So what happened? Then dental schools, you know, some of these universities started to create their own separate dental school. It was a complete separate entity. It was not in the same building. It was not with, you know, utilizing any of the same faculty. There was no cross-training that happened with any of these pieces. It was very specific or very targeted that dentistry was its own separate entity. And that really, I think, created a huge disservice because we started to see early on in the 1800s, some cooperation beginning to develop between our medical colleagues and our dental colleagues. So I love this. There is an article that was published back in 1891, and this was released by a Dr. Miller. The title of this publication is called The Human Mouth as a Focus of Infection. So Dr. Miller was one of those, he actually worked in the lab with Robert Koch, who is the one who had kind of postulated all of these concepts of like infectious diseases. And he's the one that was, you know, really focused and targeted on what these microbiological etiologies do for infectious diseases. But Miller was very focused at the time on this concept that there was a role. He believed that oral microorganisms or their byproducts. So we're not just talking about the bacteria, but the potential toxins. Remember, he and Robert were in this lab together. They're like mad scientists, like, oh my gosh, like, what is this bacteria doing? They're like totally geeking out on it, like a bunch of weirdos. So they're super like into you. This. Like me. Yeah. Cause I totally love this stuff too. Right. So they're studying this, and he postulated that oral microorganisms or their byproducts could leverage or develop a variety of diseases. He said that if we had oral microorganisms in the oral cavity, that he believed that these oral microorganisms could be responsible for brain abscesses, pulmonary diseases, gastric problems, as well as a number of systemic infectious diseases. And this was actually published 1891, which is absolutely incredible. Then William Hunter, who was at the time in 1910, was a British physician, wrote, and they say with considerable hyperbole, by the way, about dental restorations, and that if a patient has dental decay, that this could be a source of sepsis. And he actually said that this source of sepsis, there is no parallel in the whole realm of medicine. That is a quote from him. There is no parallel in the whole realm of medicine of what having sepsis in the oral cavity could do for a patient. So this is really where a lot of this conversation started to come from. Then from there, a cooperation started to develop in 1911. Frank Billings used the term focal infection to describe all sources of bacteria, including the teeth, the tonsils, and the adenoids. 6 years later, he published a retrospective survey reporting that 23% of his arthritic patients were relieved of their arthritis, 46% of them improved their symptoms if there was a complete removal of the focal infection. So this, again, is going to be a patient who had infected tonsils, infected adenoids, infected teeth, infected gums, draining abscesses, fistulas in the mouth, that if you could remove or treat that focal infection. He started, now again, this is in the early 1900s, 1911, right? Hygienists weren't even a thing yet. We didn't come around until 1913, by the way. So we weren't even born yet. I definitely wasn't born yet. but what we found was this concept that if we could treat these sources of infection, that patients saw better results. They saw a systemic relief of their infections. In 1919, Rosenow, this is a shout out to our friends at the Mayo Clinic, shout out to our Minnesotans, published a series of human case reports as well as animal experiments that really started to support this concept of focal infection. He really emphasized that there needed to be a cooperation between dentists and physicians, that this was a necessity to ensure that the focus of infection is eliminated completely. And he stated that tooth extraction by itself might not be sufficient. So the problem was in the early 1900s, this was anecdotal. You know, they would, you know, use human case reports and say, well, it might be a good idea if they would consider some of these things. But what we really needed to focus on was starting to develop true correlative studies, studies that say what it is that we research now, which is if you have, you know, bacteria in the mouth, you can easily aspirate that bacteria, that Bacteroides aureolus, Fusobacterium nucleatum, that these bacteria can enter the lungs and can certainly, you know, elevate the risk of a respiratory tract infection, that if you have bacteria in the oral cavity and it enters the bloodstream, turns out that bacteria in the oral cavity love to form biofilm or be a part of biofilm. They have characteristics or qualities that, you know, encourage them to anchor in or stick to things like, I don't know, the lining of the carotid arteries, the lining of, you know, the microvasculature that we know can contribute to things. And we've started even now see studies that for example, when you siphon out the brain fluid, or do a spinal tap on somebody who has arthritis, or that has Alzheimer's disease, 96% of those individuals demonstrate Porphyromonas gingivalis bacterial cells that have colonized the brain. Wow. So we've found these pieces to be true, and yet we have to rewind and go back to, but we get so freaked out about what to do the moment the patient has had an episode, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. We get so freaked out. You know, you mentioned it. It's like, well, you know, if this is creating a problem, like if there's an infection, sure, I'll treat it. I guess my question to dentistry is the mouth a source of infection? Is it truly a source of infection? Do we see inflammation all the time? Do we see restorations in the oral cavity that become a nodus for bacteria? Is the mouth, I mean, we thought we genomed over 700 microbiological organisms in the oral cavity. That number is now over 1,000 different types of bacteria in the oral cavity. And some are health producing. Most that we see today in the oral cavities of those who have systemic disease, who have dysbiosis, who have an acidic pH in their oral cavity because of dry mouth, because of medications that they're on, patients that, you know, their immune system is delayed, patients that have candida, which by the way, is in high concentrations. And like, for example, our diabetic patients, right? And it's an opportunistic infection. So when we take a look at these microorganisms that the average person who has infection in their body, is it safe to say that this came from, or this source is the oral cavity? It is a portal to the rest of the body, right? So the question being, you know, how is it that we manage this? And one of the things that I want to share, and we can just kind of giggle about this together, because it just kind of cracks me up. The hygienic treatment of teeth, and they called teeth organs at this time. I'm reading a passage from the American Journal of Dental Science, by the way. And in this journal, when they call the teeth organs,
I love that.
They say, well, it's true, right? Like yes. your tooth is a body part, is what I say when I, you know, lecture about.
The skin is an organ.
The skin is an organ, totally, right? Your teeth are an organ, you know, not just for the tooth fairy to collect, but like it's like a legit organ, right? So they, at the time in the 1800s, when this concept came out, they described what hygienic treatment for these organs should look like. And get this, they said it consists of cleaning the teeth regularly, 4 or 5 times a day with waxed floss silk. Every dentist should be provided with an abundant supply and should furnish every one of his patients with it. This is how you know this was in the 1800s, because they referred to dentists as his, when the vast majority of graduating dentists today are female.
Really?
Go women power.
Yeah.
And they actually say that any materials that can be used to keep the teeth organs clean to promote dental hygiene is absolutely critical. Again, now this came from the 1800s. So this is before hygienists came along. And it was interesting. And I do want to do just a short shout out to hygienists, that one of the critical pieces that we found in conceptualizing dental hygienists and now creating something that helped educate the community. That's really where Irene Newman, the very first dental hygienist, came from, was this concept of we need to be able to educate the community. People are walking around with infection in their mouth. And this was in the early 1900s. I laugh because the reality is it is still happening today, right?
Mm-hmm.
But people are walking around with infection in their mouth. And so maybe we shouldn't just be sitting and waiting for these people to have oral disease where we need to extract teeth. Maybe we can empower somebody to come in and be a preventive specialist. They can educate the community and help them understand what it is that you do to control the focal point of infection, right? So this whole concept being we should train dental hygienists to do this. So Alfred Fones trained his cousin, Irene Newman, to become the first licensed dental hygienist. This was actually in Connecticut, by the way, in 1914 is when she graduated. And she started going into schools with her classmates and teaching the school-aged children about how to keep their teeth and gums clean and healthy. And what's interesting about this is Dr. Fones has been notated, a true achievement of his has been notated because the city of Bridgeport, Connecticut reported the lowest death rate of any large city in the 1918 Spanish influenza. It is believed that a massive contributory factor to this is the fact that in Bridgeport, Connecticut, that's where the very first dental hygiene school came from. That's where Irene Newman was with all of her dental hygienists. It is believed that the work of these dental hygienists helped to contribute to the lowest death rate of any large city from the 1918 influenza pandemic at the time. So I just incredible information as you really start to unpack it. And so, you know, I guess the wraparound question that I have for you is, because you study about how, you know, you mentioned if a patient has an infected toenail, that infected toenail becomes a focal point of infection. Yes, that bacteria from that infected toenail, that infected toe, that infected foot, that infected lower, you know, limb, you call them. The below knee limbs, which, by the way, I thought you meant like, I was like yesterday years old when I realized you weren't saying baloney, like Oscar Mayer baloney, but like below the knee. So thank you.
You got that from dad, didn't you? Was that your baloney or your high knee?
I remember when dad, my knee hurts. Is that your baloney or your high knee? Oh, he thought that was so funny. It is funny, but the whole point being, you know, interestingly enough, as we really unpack a lot of these pieces, the important piece in all of this really comes down to when we see these focal points of infection, and we see these oftentimes in patients that do have other underlying conditions, what is our responsibility? What is our role? Because this research that came out of the 1800s, the early 1900s say that part of the treatment of some of these systemic diseases, part of the treatment for arthritis, part of the treatment for patient pain is removing that focal point of infection. So where are we in this process of looking at that risk to benefit ratio and saying, do I provide care? Do I not provide care? You know, I know that we are unfortunately in a world today where I think many medical and dental colleagues do have concerns about legalities and not just, hey, that's a focal point of infection. I know you had a heart attack last week, but we need to remove this. But really critically looking at that risk to benefit ratio, is that something that you do with your diabetic patients? Let's say, for example, a diabetic patient comes in, their A1C, and most of the time they don't know they're diabetic. So they come in, right? They have a diabetic foot ulcer. You know that that ulcer is contributing to systemic disease, right? You know that, but it is the systemic disease that likely caused the ulcer to begin with, right? So it's this weird, like cyclical thing, right? The disease caused the ulcer, maybe. Patient was more prone to it, maybe. But now it's like, well, I can't treat your ulcer until I control your disease. But part of controlling your disease would be treating the ulcer. So where does your thought process go? How do you process this in medicine? What does that look like?
Gosh, everything you're talking about just hits home, because I think about a patient, for example, and I think I'm probably going to make you cringe when I describe this all. Let's say a patient comes into my clinic and they have an ulcer on the tip of their toe that what we call probes to bone, or rather that there's an exposed bone on the toe. Okay. Mm-hmm. This would warrant admitting a patient to the hospital, starting them on intravenous antibiotics, discussing amputation of the infected bone. The infectious disease team and the medicine team would all get on board, and the infectious disease team would be on us to amputate whatever bone is infected. Now, think about this. This is a hospital admission. This is a lot of money, even if the patient is not very sick. Let's say their white blood cell count is normal. Even their, you know, usually it's not. Usually it's elevated, and their CRP and SED rates are also elevated. But I can assure you that the infectious disease team will want us to amputate as much of the infection as possible. Another option would be 6 weeks of IV antibiotics. So really, that's what we offer the patient. You know, you have your option. Unfortunately, if they have peripheral vascular disease, that can warrant us to get our vascular surgeons on board first before we do any sort of intervention. But the standard of care for an infection in the bone of the foot is to admit them, perform surgery, and try to get all the infected bone out, and then eventually to close. Now I'm thinking about you telling me about an infected tooth, and we talk about how the mouth is the gateway to the entire body. So everything that goes by that tooth, you know, the food that I eat, the food that I consume is now going through my digestive tract, and that's being absorbed along with the nutrients or lack thereof in my gut. We're not even talking about that, again, it's so close to your brain. So this can lead to brain abscesses. This can lead to, we talked about endocarditis. There have been very significant associations between periodontal infections and systemic diseases, of course, like diabetes, respiratory diseases, metabolic syndrome, low birth weight, and even different cancers. You had mentioned Alzheimer's disease as well, and even rheumatoid arthritis. So these people with this chronic pain that probably could be coming from the tooth. So why are we taking a toe? Please, I'm not diminishing my profession, but why are we taking a small toe where we're admitting a patient to the hospital and multiple teams are getting on board? And trust me, I know it's severe because an infection can spread up the leg. People can get bacteremic from it and cause endocarditis from their toe, but this could also be a source from the mouth, right? So this is where I think you're absolutely right. I think we need to be taking this way more seriously than we are. And preventative medicine is really where it needs to, we need to get on board with that, I think.
Yeah. You know, and it's interesting. I it's so funny how our brains are aligned. Cause I literally just wrote like, when you talk about infection of the bone, my question is, where does it come from? So it's interesting because it's like, we can say like, oh, you have infection in this because you have diabetes, but that's actually not true. The diabetes certainly makes it worse. You have delayed wound healing. You have a delayed immune system. So your immune system is not stepping in to fight. Like, absolutely. I'm super in alignment with that. I get that. But where did that infection come from? Like, how did that form? What happened? And so I think that's the big question. Like, I mean, not to be like weird about it, but like, if you ever watch somebody, like a dude, get a pedicure and like, they try to like, those ladies are so amazing. They're like, would you like us to do like the cheese grater thing that like removes like 7 millimeters of like your tissue? You know what I mean? Like,
I hate that.
Like, is that bad? Should we not be doing that? By the way, we should be removing that, right?
It can be done. I would just prefer you use more of like a pet egg or something that's more of like a sandpaper. Cause I don't know if you remember one time you and I were getting a pedicure and my pedicurist just like ignored me. It like turned her head as she was doing it. And I couldn't go for a run for a week after she lacerated my foot, but it's all right. But
you're like the wrong person that I would want to lacerate a foot, by the way.
You said, by the way, she's a foot doctor. And she was like, okay.
Show me watching. She was like, okay. And then she didn't watch. No, totally. So, but I guess what I mean to say is like, it's keratinized, right? Like it's, what's the palmar plantar hyperkeratosis disease? Not Chidock Higashi, Papillon Lefèvre. So Papillon Lefèvre, for example, there are some diseases.
So smart.
These are just the things that I think about. I'm like, oh my gosh, what is that? But you know, so there are certain diseases where like we do see hyperkeratosis built up because of a disease. But the reality is like your feet have like a mucosal, like it's got a membrane on it. It's got skin. It's supposed to be protected. Like
that's correct. Calluses form because it's your body's mechanism to protect itself from creating an ulcer. So you're supposed to develop them through time, you know, and
exactly.
That's where I think coming, like we shave them down in our podiatry clinic, but to constantly be doing that I would be very careful when you get a pedicure.
For sure. So thank you. I will. I hope that My sweet pickle bear fiance is not listening to this episode because every time we go, I'm like, he'll have the cheese grater thing and get in there, remove what you need. He's like all embarrassed. But at any rate, the whole point being like, these are protected tissues. So where does this bacteria come from? What is happening? So you see infection because people will, you know, oh, I was walking around barefoot and I stepped on blah, blah, blah. And I got, you know, like when we hiked Mount Kilimanjaro, we had to get the tetanus shot because they said, you know, it is possible you could step on something and hurt yourself. So we had to do that like prophylactically, right? Mm-hmm. So yes, infection can happen from like, oh, I stepped on this and I poked myself or whatever. But when you talk about some of these, for lack of a better term, like endogenous infection, like that comes from within, it's like, but where did that bacteria come from? And I think that's really the scintillating piece for me. We don't know, you know, we're doing a lot of research. I know that in your line of work, if there's an infection, you typically gather a culture to kind of see what bacteria so that you know what type mm-hmm. of antibiotics. And by the way, putting a patient on IV antibiotics for 6 weeks is like quite concerning for many reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure that several of you driving to work, like, I hope you didn't get in a car accident. Like what? Cause that's a lot for a patient. And mm-hmm. oftentimes these are immunocompromised patients that we don't want to be building a resistance, a bacterial
or
resistance.
Or ruining their kidneys.
Mm-hmm. Or yeah, blowing out their kidneys, blowing out their gut flora. Like this is mm-hmm. crazy that this is what we do. Mm-hmm. But the reality is we have to go back to like, where the heck did this come from? And one of the benefits to preventive medicine is that it really focuses on, you know, targeting a lot of these areas and treating them or trying to address them so that they don't become a focal point of infection down the road. We look at the amount of disease that's there, I think it's important for us to critically examine that.
So in the foot, usually ulcers will form from, you know, and you mentioned it, usually they're diabetic because they have almost a neuropathy and they'll get an ulcer on a pressure point. So would it, and I'm picturing how someone might get an infection in their mouth. Could it be from like a loose tooth that with time just becomes even more loose? People just keep eating different foods. And I'm wondering do you guys get like a neuropathy of the mouth? Probably. Does neuropathy affect the small nerves to your mouth? Probably.
Okay. So this is a fabulous question. Now, for our listeners, describe neuropathy.
So neuropathy, at least of the feet, is a condition that affects the small sensory nerves. There are many different causes that could lead to neuropathy. Most commonly, I tell my patients diabetes is the most common. And when I talk to my diabetic patients, I say, you know, the blood sugar is basically coating the nerves and the impulses can't necessarily go down the nerves. Now, I'm very good at talking to patients in simple terms, not the best at talking to smart people like you, but this is what I described.
No. So I guess, I want to make sure that like we fully understand. So when you're talking about neuropathy, you mean the patient should have pain, but they don't. And because the blood glucose is, you know, coating the nerve, which is a beautiful way of describing it. So the idea being they have an infection. There is disease happening, but their nervous system is not telling them immediately that there's a problem. And it's amazing because dental professionals, those of you again, who are driving to work, you are nodding, right? You're like, yep. Because I say all the time, wouldn't it be amazing if gum disease actually hurt? Now the nerve endings in the oral cavity are quite different. We have nerve endings everywhere. We're primarily focused on that trigeminal nerve, the fifth cranial nerve, that trigeminal nerve. Mostly we're focused on the second and third division. But within that nerve, what we've found is that in the space of infection, when there is disease or infection that starts to form, there is vasodilation occurring because the body is trying to send blood to the area to treat this, you know, issue. We do oftentimes see with that vasodilation that there's a lot of edema, a lot of inflammatory fluids in those areas. It becomes extremely acidic in those areas, which makes it hard for us to use local anesthesia to anesthetize the patient. And to your point, yes, we do run into issues where oral disease doesn't hurt oftentimes until it's too late. Not always, Because of course, as much as we wish that patients would experience pain, patient will have like an incredibly bombed out tooth. And it's like, doesn't that bother you? And they're like, nope, doesn't bother me at all. You know, people walking around with root tips in their mouth and they're like, oh no, it's like not a big deal. Or they'll have like periodontal disease. Like you're probing like 7, 8, 9 millimeter pockets and it doesn't bother them until you probe them. Then it bothers them, of course, because you're using a blunt object, you know. And they're like, oh no, it doesn't bother me at all. Like no pain whatsoever, like no big. And you're like, okay, that's quite concerning because you really should have pain. By the time the patient does have pain, that tooth is coming out, you know, there's something major going on. Honestly, patients get abscesses in their mouth, like draining abscesses that look like a giant pimple and they'll pop it. And then like, they're like, oh yeah, there's like fluid that came out.
Oh my gosh.
Did you swallow that? Like, what are we doing here? You know what I mean? And yeah, or sometimes they have a fistula and they have no idea. And we see them, you know, for their routine hygiene visit. And we're like, did you notice that was there? And they're like, no, I had no idea. And you're like, there's just like a pimple in your mouth and you have no idea. And like, I guess I got a bad taste in this area. So I think it's interesting, you know, as we kind of wrap up today's program, oh, how juicy talking about pus, talking about all this stuff. But as we wrap up today's program, I think it's really important as we focus on, you know, where our responsibility lies. Yes, we experience patients that have, for lack of a better term, I guess, neuropathy in the oral cavity. No, it doesn't mean that they have pins and needles of their lips or their tongue. But what I do mean to say is the body does a beautiful job of shutting off those pain receptors, which makes it very challenging for us to help educate the patient. And it certainly makes it difficult for us to really empower the patient to make a decision because our patients that come in sit in our chairs in a perceived state of health. They do believe that because nothing hurts, there's nothing wrong. And again, this is where we start to really look at the critical role that preventive specialists play in screening for those diseases. That just because it doesn't hurt does not mean that the patient does not have disease. And in fact, because it doesn't hurt, perhaps, you know, this is our opportunity to treat this disease now before it becomes an advanced problem. Thank you so much for joining me, Katrina Sanders, and my sister, Dr. Elizabeth Sanders, on our first episode of 2023. So glad to have you joining us. If you enjoyed listening to today's episode, please tell your friends, send this along to somebody who would love to hear some information about juicy pus on their morning drive into work. We would love to be in their ear. But with that, thank you for joining us. Our friends at Dental Products Report and Modern Hygienist are so kind to publish this episode for us. So thank you to our producers there for their wonderful support. Join us for Floss and Flip Flops next month as we continue the conversation and brush up on oral systemic content.
We promise to keep you on your toes.
Thank you for joining us for another monthly episode of Floss and Flip Flops with the Sanders Sisters.
Thank you for being part of the change we need to see in the medical and dental professions.
Join us next month for another sister-to-sister chat about other unique, interesting, and perhaps provocative and disruptive health topics.
Don't forget to like and subscribe, and maybe even leave a fabulous review.
And we'll catch you next month for another episode of
Floss and Flip Flops
with the Sanders Sisters.
I love you, Kinka.
I love you, Izzy.